Our next guest is a New York Times best-selling author and journalist from Roanoke. Her best-selling award-winning books include Factory Man and True Vine, and the latest is Dope Sick: Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. Beth Macy joins us now. Beth, good morning. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much. Good morning.
This book, amazing, just documenting America's 20-plus year struggle with opioid addiction. And it's you in the Roanoke area have lived through this. I mean, tell us how you came to write this book.
Sure. So I was a longtime newspaper reporter for the Roanoke Times for 25 years. And one of the last big projects I did before I left to work full time on books was a series I did about heroin when it landed. Let's say not when it landed, because it landed earlier, but when it came to the wide public's attention about 2012. And so I followed these two upper middle class families from this suburb called Hidden Valley, whose lives had been upended by heroin. One, their son had died, and the other, their son was about to go to prison for his role in the classmate's death. And everybody was super surprised. They like literally spit their coffee up and said, "What? Holy crap, wealthy white kids are doing heroin? We had no idea." And of course, this is an epidemic that was really started in the mid to late 90s with the whole pharma push notion that we were untreating pain, and the introduction of OxyContin in 1996. But nobody, it took a long time to put all the pieces together to see that the opiate pill thing was really what was pushing, driving the heroin epidemic and now fentanyl epidemic.
And so why Appalachia so hard hit rather than other parts of the country for Virginia, you know, that far southwest? What made those people that much more vulnerable, I guess I'll say?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's, you know, it's actually every place is vulnerable now, and that's one of the messages of the book. But it began in distress regions, not just Appalachia, but all distress regions that were losing jobs or had high incidence of workplace injuries or extractive injuries. So, say, furniture towns like Martinsville, Henry County, Alta Vista, for instance, in your neck of the woods, a lot of jobs lost when the furniture factories went away, and a lot of workplace injuries. And out in the coal fields in Appalachia, there were textile mills closing and coal mines shutting down. And what the Purdue Pharma reps, the makers of OxyContin, realized, because they bought the data, was that the most opioid prescribing was already happening in those distressed, rural, largely rural regions. And they knew that because they bought the data. And then they sent the reps to the doctors that were prescribing competing opioids that were already in the market. And they said, "Look, we have this new drug. It lasts over 12 hours. That makes it," and key to remember is the FDA allowed them to make this squishy claim that because it lasted 12 hours, it had this time-release mechanism that was supposed to let the drug bleed into the system. You know, they let them make this drug, sell this drug that was stronger than any drug like it before. And, of course, users, as we now know, quickly figured out how to do an end run around the system and either snort it or shoot it up to get the full bump from it. And in those distress regions where you had lots of people doing the pills already, you also had so much need that people started shopping for doctors and getting extra pills in order to sell them to get money to buy their pills they actually needed or to pay their bills or whatever. And the important thing to remember is the company said that this drug wasn't addictive. We know now, of course, that it was. And that's really how we got into this heroin epidemic, because the morphine molecule has its hooks on you, it's really, really hard to get off of it.
You talk about Purdue Pharma and trying to go to doctors to get them to prescribe OxyContin. Tell us the lengths they went to, and is it fair to call what the company did bribery?
So they sent their reps out, and they paid the reps. The reps got paid more bonuses based on if they talked a doctor into prescribing higher dosages. So, like, literally, you could get $100,000 in a quarter alone, and your goal was to get somebody not to prescribe 10 milligrams. It was to prescribe 80 or 40. And they actually gave doctors gifts to remind them. One was a cup that had OxyContin logo on one side, and the other said, "The one to start with, the one to stay with. Like, we want your patients to stay with this." They really were promoting the notion, which we had known for hundreds of years, that opioids were addictive. They were promoting the notion that they were no longer addictive, and they were promoting the notion that they were safe, not just for severe and end-of-life pain, which we had, you know, of course opioids are appropriate for after surgery, for severe, severe pain, for end-of-life and cancer, but they were now saying that it was safe for people with moderate pain, back pain, arthritis, TMJ, and I wouldn't call it bribery, but I would call it, they did a lot of, you know, paying doctors to become paid speakers, paying doctors, finding out what doctors like. Like, if you were a doctor and you collected Cuban cigars, the rep would then come with your favorite kind of cigar. And it was this sort of subtle thing, and it was being pushed at doctors from all angles, that this is the one to start with and to stay with. And, of course, you know, they started with it, and it sure has stuck with us. This problem.
Speaking with Beth Macy here on Virginia's Talk Station, she's the author of Dope Sick. And following up on that, you talk about users doing, you call it an end run, when they would chop the pills up and snort them or whatever. Would Purdue Pharma's claims of this not being addictive, would those have held up true, or at least would it have been better if people had just used them as directed and just taken them, you know, orally?
Yes. But, you know, a lot of people are dependent on OxyContin now, and they take them just as prescribed orally. And the important thing, I guess, one of the big messages in my story is that once people are dependent on opioid pills, and many of them, if you just take all the pills away, people will go to the black market because this fear of dope sickness is so huge. And so that's why you saw a lot of people going to heroin when the pills got harder to get or got upscheduled. In 2010, Purdue reformulated the pills so you can no longer suck the coating off and crush it up and snort or inject it. And then the drug dealers started bringing in heroin because they knew that the fear of becoming dope sick or this terrible withdrawal was a really good business model. They would have a lot of customers if they brought heroin in. And then around 15, they started cutting the heroin fentanyl, which was even cheaper and easier to smuggle in. And the important thing is to remember that, like, this isn't a problem that goes away for people. They need to seek treatment. And John Kelly out of Harvard says that it takes the typical opioid-addicted person 8 years and 5 to 6 treatment attempts just to get 1 year of recovery. So that's how hard a nut to crack this addiction problem is. And my book argues really strongly in favor of medication-assisted treatment, which is, it's another opioid, but it's a much weaker opioid, and allows people, if they're on methadone or buprenorphine, to be much less likely to overdose and die and to relapse and to commit criminal behavior. And so there's a lot of I believe unneeded controversy around that right now. The science is super clear that is the best way forward with treatment for opioid use disorder.
Your book opens with a story of a heroin dealer who comes to town and basically gets the football stars addicted, high school football. A very compelling open. Why did you start with this? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I had interviewed this mom at her child's gravesite, and she had him buried at the edge of the cemetery, which is right next to Strasburg High School. And Strasburg's in the northern Shenandoah Valley. And she asked me to meet her there. She wanted me to see his grave, and he had been this high school football star, that just really charismatic kid. And he had gotten addicted to oxycodone-based pills after a football and or snowboarding injuries. I mean, the important thing to realize, she didn't know exactly when he got addicted because, you know, people are really good at hiding this for a long time until it sort of outs them. But when the pills got hit, hard to get, Jesse, her son, then started going to the black market for heroin, driving up to Baltimore and whatnot. And then this dealer, Ronnie Jones, lands in the region and starts importing heroin from Harlem. Almost overnight, the town goes from having a handful of users to hundreds, and the town of Woodstock, actually that region. And the reason Jesse was in that sort of seeded heroin epidemic. But there were already a lot of kids addicted to the opioid pills. But that just made it worse when heroin in bulk started coming in. And, of course, they send it down here because they can sell it for a lot more than they can in New York and then the big cities. And so she asked me to find out because she couldn't understand. She thought it was just pills. Like, how could her beautiful son, he never missed a day of work. He was a construction worker, you know, was 19 years old. How did he end up on someone else's bathroom floor? And so that's sort of the question driving the whole book at the beginning. I'm driving up to West Virginia to a federal prison to meet this guy. And is he really the monster that the feds made him out to be? What can I help this mother that will help her understand why her kids and why 72,000 Americans last year died of this? That maybe she can help other mothers understand and prevent it from happening to them.
Now, you talk about people going from the prescription medicines to the illegal drugs. Are there more overdoses on, you know, OxyContin and the prescription medicines or on heroin and the illegal things?
Fentanyl is largely what people are dying from now. Not as many on prescriptions. I mean, there still are a lot of drug deaths from prescriptions. But, I mean, the important thing to remember is that a lot of times the kids will start with the pills. They think the pills are safer because they're, quote, FDA approved. And then once they are hooked, they'll go to anything. And the pills have gotten increasingly hard to get because the CDC guidelines, because doctors are being better about not over-prescribing them, not realizing that the one to start with and the one to stay with is might be a good model for capitalism, but it is not a good model for healthcare. We do not, for hundreds of years, we knew that opioids were addictive, and just because Purdue put this so-called safe time-release mechanism on their drug didn't mean people weren't going to figure out how to misuse it almost immediately, which they did. So, I mean, the important thing is to remember they are both connected. Once you're addicted, once you have that first time of being, quote, dope sick or in this painful withdrawal, that molecule has its hooks in you, and you need to seek out help via medication-assisted treatment and therapy, because that is what science says is the number one way to turning back this crisis.
We're speaking with Beth Macy. Her new book is Dope Sick. Do you address the toll that this has on communities economically, healthcare-wise, that kind of thing?
Yes, yes, I do. I spend a lot of time. I mean, it really, well, if I had to say what the book is about in a sentence, I would say this book shows how we're leaving it largely to the institution of the American family to deal with the worst drug epidemic in the history of our nation. The toll on families, the toll on first responders. I mean, I watched drug court judge's hair turn white in the course of the 1 year that I was following him. I followed a police officer who was inadvertently stuck with a dirty needle harboring hepatitis C. He had to get tested for a whole year. He's fine, thank goodness. I mean, economically, one report has the cost of the epidemic by the early 2020s as high as $1 trillion. If you look at lost productivity, healthcare, law enforcement, lost productivity because these people are simply gone and they're not there to take care of their families. The impact on the foster care system is just huge as well. And this is really a national disaster. We need more leadership at every level, national, state, local, in my opinion.
And
because you're going to be at Sweetbriar speaking later this week, but just I wanted to pick up what you just said there. Is there anything encouraging? I mean, you have national leaders, you have state leaders. They were just at, the governor was at Liberty University at the medical school last week talking about dealing with this crisis. Are you optimistic at all with what people are saying anyway?
I think they're saying the right things. I want them to start doing the right things. I want them to start putting significant money into getting people access to treatment. I mean, we're basically just treating it like it's a criminal justice issue, not a medical health issue. We don't view these addicted people as patients in need of medical care until we're sitting in their funeral pews. And, the president said he was going to name it a national emergency, and so he named it a public health emergency, which released no new funds or authority. We need to see real action over a number of years. One of my persons that I followed the longest, who died on Christmas Eve, her body was found in a dumpster. She was murdered because she ended up, I mean, this is somebody, her dad is a surgeon, her mother's a nurse. vacation home on Ballhead Island. Not the kind of person you would think of that ends up homeless, addicted, and prostituting on the streets of Las Vegas, where she had initially been sent to go to an abstinence-only rehab center. This is what's happening to our children from all walks of life. And as she said, the very first time I interviewed her, she explained how she had been originally addicted at an urgent care center. She had bronchitis and was sent home with two 30-day prescriptions that had opioids in them. She said, we need urgent care for the addicted. And that's really the only way we're going to turn this back is to make easy entry, low threshold places in our community where users can go and not be treated like dirt and get help for their problem. I mean, stigma is still really huge. And when Tess says we need urgent care for the addicted, I think it took me about 2.5 years to realize what it was she was talking about. But I saw her just being denied life-saving access to medication and treatment, medication-assisted treatment, over and over in her journey until she ends up at the bottom of a dumpster. Mm. And that's kind of like, that's such a metaphor for the way we're treating people with this disease.
Beth Macy is going to be speaking at Sweetbriar on Thursday at 7:30. And so we look forward to your visit to Sweetbriar, sbc.edu, if you want more information on Beth's speech. And Beth, thank you so much. The book is called Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.